Hey there, welcome to Sauce and Bomb Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Dana, Head of Growth at Sauce Group, serial acquirer, buying wonderful sauce businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get the inside scoop on how they made their business a success. So today with me is Matt, CEO of Quist, a full-stack open finance platform connecting third-party providers with financial data and services. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, you know, that was a very kind of high level what you do. And I want to get deeper into this, but maybe let's start with your background because, you know, this is very close to home, honestly. You joined Quist after a merger as a CEO. We often hire CEOs after acquisition is done at Sauce Group. So it's very interesting, you know, to learn about your story and how you joined, how you feel about this and how to connect those two companies, how you're doing this now without losing momentum and, you know, merging maybe the best of two worlds. But let's start with you. How did you get to do this?
So, well, I got to do this because, I mean, I think I moved to Berlin about 5 years ago to do a turnaround and sale of a SEO SaaS business. And having done that, I was just contemplating taking a few months off and going skiing when I was introduced to the world of open finance. Now, a long way back in my career, I had actually been in finance tech in something called OLAP, which was very large amounts of data and using AI and various other means to make sense of that and to provide information. And I admit to being something of a skeptic to start with. I was going, hang on a minute, open banking. What's the use case? Where's the business? Because I think we've all seen a lot of hype in the market and a lot of excitement about the potential. But when I'm looking at it, what I was seeing was things like multi-banking, which is useful, but it's not a killer app. So from my perspective, I took a little bit of convincing, but then once I understood the prospective value in that market, the things that you really could do that would add real value, and the fact that that wasn't being realized at the time, that's what got me excited. And looking at two businesses that had really some absolutely fantastic tech, but were not successful commercially. And for me, that's always an attractive position. A market which has a lot of potential, that's got past that initial hype stage and is now looking, okay, what are we really going to do with this in the market? Who's going to benefit from this? How are we going to create value? And also, how are we going to take this massive, complex setup with all kinds of technology and turn it into something that's coherent, straightforward, and can actually resonate in the market? So that's why I joined. I kind of went, this is an exciting thing to do. As ever, you know, it has proven tricky, you know, things that you think are simple. Sometimes turn out to be very complicated and vice versa. But I think overall, I'm going to use a sort of motoring analogy. I think, you know, if you look at a car or a motorbike, there's tens of thousands, possibly even hundreds of thousands of components in that. So, but you're not selling those components in general. What you're selling is the net package that is a vehicle that does X, whether that is go very fast, whether it's transport a large number of people, whether it's look particularly stylish and make a great noise. And I think really for me, that actually is a lot like putting together two businesses where you look at it and go, what have we got here? What have we got in terms of the technology? How do we put it together? Who do we actually provide a benefit to? And how do we make sure that is what we really deliver? And so we, for example, had a situation where, as you mentioned, we've really got two parts of our business. One part of our business is we sell to the banks technology that allows them to meet their PSD requirements. So we stage the data into a publicly available API to a standard that's defined by something called the Berlin Group, but fundamentally is actually based on a European piece of legislation. So they have to do that. And then the other side of it is, well, okay, now you've got 4,000, well, way more than 4,000 these days, banks across Europe. How do you then take information out of bank accounts and do something useful for the consumer and make life easier, make life possible in terms of certain aspects that previously weren't available before. You know, in that sense, it's simple, but then the complexity comes. Well, if you can imagine, if you talk to an individual bank, they all have something slightly different in terms of their setup, different core banking, different subsidiary systems, different approaches to how they're going to stay compliant, which means if you look at it from a technology perspective, you could say, hang on a minute, we've got all these customers and they're all slightly different. That's a level of complexity. So how do you create value out of that? And our answer to that was, well, hang on a minute, what we've got right now is this situation. But what if instead, rather than having a business model and a technology delivery model that says, okay, we have some core technology, but each client is going to get different setup, different pieces of code. And every time that the standards change, we're going to go back to them and say, ah, well, you know, you've got to pay for this little extra module, or you've got to pay for this one to be changed. What if we completely turned that on its head? What if we said, we'll keep the core platform always up to date and standard? That actually reduces the amount of work that we have to do because we now have one platform. The implementation layer now gets separated out, and the pitch to the client has fundamentally changed. That's why I used the car analogy, right? Because now what we're saying to them is not, here, would you like to buy some technology that solves your problem, but you're still owning the problem? What we're saying to them now, and that has been very successful, is we will solve the problem. We will host it. We will deliver it. We will keep it up to date. And we'll even, if you want, operate it so that when a third-party processor wants to access that data and perhaps has a problem, we'll provide that support and we'll provide the reporting and the compliance that is required by the regulator. So if you think about it, you've taken something which is very complicated, you've massively simplified it, you've created value because now what you're saying to the customer, and the customer is now, to be candid, a different individual within the hierarchy of the bank. Customer is now somebody who is responsible for ensuring that the business meets its compliance requirements because they get fined quite heavily if they don't. And also they want that data to be available so that they can perform all the good things such as, you know, simplified account switching, better credit rating, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what I mean, where you sort of start off with two businesses, a lot of technology, and a lot of components. And the opportunity that that gives is to step back and go, hang on a second, let's look at this in a different way. Because, and I can say this with a straight face because I'm an ex-techie myself from a long time ago, but you know, I still have certain techie instincts. You know, as technologists, we love a component or a, you know, fantastic piece of code that does something clever. But in general, that is or can be a weakness if that's what you get excited about. Because when you're talking to a client and you say, hey, you know, this adheres to the latest technology standards and it's faster and it's better, but the client goes, well, hang on a second, I'm in an environment where it's human powered, somebody's sitting in front of a screen and doing something, they're switching their bank account from bank A to us. They don't react in, you know, fractions of a millisecond. So I really don't care about that. That's not really what I'm interested in. So that's, you know, this is how I get excited about the opportunities to, if you like, you end up almost with a Lego brick situation. You know, there's all the Lego bricks. What are you going to build? And also then on the people side, how are you going to get people aligned around that? Okay. Because, and the fintech space is a really challenging one in that sense, because obviously as a scale-up business, you want to encourage ownership, entrepreneurial behavior within the team. At the same time, you're subject to very strict regulation and compliance. Right? You cannot do certain things. You have to stay, you know, rigidly adherent to certain policies because, you know, you're regulated by, in our case, BaFin. So that also creates an interesting challenge and was one very much here at Quisp because we started with two businesses and initially we couldn't share data between those two businesses because one was regulated and held a BaFin license and the other one wasn't. So as part of our merger, we had to deal with that. And we also had to change the thinking within the business and get people to think, well, where's this line between regulation and wanting people to take ownership, to make things happen, and to say, hang on, well, I know we've already done it, always done it this way, but this is how we do it differently.
Yeah, I'm always
Sorry,
curious.
long answer.
That's okay. No, it's very interesting. First of all, when you were talking about just changing the kind of the core proposition, I felt like, okay, that might have been a blessing for your tech team because it probably reduced the technical debt quite a bit, because you no longer have to work with every single bank asking for every single component. But also, when you started talking about, this merger situation, how one business is different to another, and obviously, we are dealing with a bit of a different situation. We don't merge companies, we just acquire them. But yet, every time a new CEO joins, I'm thinking, okay, where do you start? Like, you walk into this company that's been growing without you, and you have very vague understanding of where do you start? And you were, well, stepping into two. So what is the mindset there? Like, if somebody is joining already an established company, somebody that joined maybe a group or merged with somebody else, where do you think they should begin?
So, are you saying at the point that they join or beforehand?
Let's start before. What did you do before? Like, what kind of, yeah, what kind of setup did you walk in with?
Okay, so speaking candidly, in this instance, I didn't get to do what I would actually recommend most people do when making an acquisition. So, in the past, I've been in a position working for a larger company where we acquired a number of smaller businesses. And what we always did there was had a very clear understanding of where the business fitted. You know, what within the overall offering that we made to the market, where did that new business fit? And I think that's where you have to start. If you don't have a clear conception of that, if you're just going, hey, this is a business that is doing well, we're acquiring it, then you've got an awful lot of work to do. So I would always say, when you know, right from the get-go, where does this fit within the vision and the strategy of the business? Does it require you to change that strategy? And if you can be clear on that, then you're also fairly clear what kind of merger it's going to look like. So, for example, and completely different examples here. So, with the larger company that I was running in Asia Pacific, we went on a bit of a buying spree. Mostly, we bought technology that we could fit within our overall offering. So, we had a strong market and we were looking for more products to sell into that market. As a result, we tended to buy tech. And in general, in some cases, we got rid of homegrown tech and replaced it with the acquired technology because it was better. Prior to completing the transaction, we actually had already made the decision as to who would do what within the new group structure. And I think that is actually something that I would say is if you possibly can, and I couldn't do it with Quest, but if you possibly can, do that. Because then you avoid this interregnum period where inevitably, a lot of people are sitting there going, well, who am I going to report to? What's my role in the new organization? All of these things. And that is, you can really create very large problems. And I've seen that, running an incubator within a PLC in the UK, where they acquired all these businesses, but there wasn't a clear strategy other than we need to be in digital media. Therefore, oh, look, this is digital media. But they then had to go, well, what do we do with it? And that essentially you've got something that's a small business that's used to running at 900 miles an hour because they're always facing a wall if they don't either grow or get to profitability. And then suddenly you've got an organization going, well, hold on a second, hold on, we've just got to decide who's doing what. And that is so demotivating for a team. So number one, I would always say if you possibly can, make that decision beforehand, be firm with it. I mean, if you don't need somebody, ideally they leave with a smile on their face, but you need to be clear. And I would say, you know, where it's been most successful, in some cases you have to look internally and go, well, you know what, this company we're hiring, this person actually looks better than our incumbent. So we're going to replace the incumbent with somebody that we brought in from an acquired business. If you do that, the level of engagement you get from the acquired team is actually very, very significant. They go, oh, this isn't, we're not just being bought for a bit of tech. We're actually being looked at as part of the organization. We are genuinely becoming part of the organization. So that's something I would always push people to consider when you're, if you're making an acquisition. Be very honest and say, hang on a minute, are we acquiring people who potentially can replace some of our incumbents? Because that does have, whilst it doesn't, not necessarily going to be so happy for the incumbents, it really cements the position of that new acquisition into your organization.
If you can't comment on that, just a quick one, because I think this is something super important. In before I was with SaaS Group, I never thought about it, and even for some time with SaaS Group, I thought, okay, well, you like you said, you acquire a company, and then with people, you get who you get, and then you kind of roll with it, and then you see what they do, and it kind of just comes after the acquisition. And then I thought, okay, so what is HR due diligence for? I thought, oh my God, this is, you know, this may be just a waste of time. And then when I dug a little bit deeper into this, I came to the exact same conclusion, that you know exactly who you're getting, and if they're staying or going, or, you know, repositioning, you're repositioning them within the larger group. And then you have this idea right away. So people know from the get-go what they're getting. So I think it's just something to pinpoint here, just so people think about this before they go into any kind of process.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that, because it's funny, when I say that, a lot of people go like, what? You know, we lose an incumbent member and replace them with somebody from a business we're acquiring. We don't do that. You know, we're the acquirer. And I'm saying, well, you know, if you want that business to really be integrated, and if you don't really want that business integrated, why are you buying it, to be candid? Because otherwise you could just own it. If you're not going to integrate it, why buy it? Just own it, but leave it to run separately. But that's, I'd say that's not really a full acquisition. So I think, yeah, it's critical. Now, if you can't do that, and obviously I joined a business which had two separate management teams and two very different, you know, leaders, very different styles. And that's tricky, because then you have to say, okay, how do we create a single team? How do we get everybody to feel that we are one business and to act as one business? We had the issue, as I said, for quite some while, in that until we legally merged, so initially there was a top co sitting elsewhere that owned the two subsidiaries. And as one of them was regulated, as I mentioned, and one not, that created a lot of issues, right, in terms of acting as one team, because literally some data, you know, you couldn't share. You couldn't say, okay, to somebody, okay, well, we're going to have one sales team. But if the head of sales can't actually see the personnel details of some of the people because they are, you know, sitting on the other side of essentially a firewall because of regulation, yeah, that creates issues. But where you have that, you just have to be really clear about where you're going and what the character of the company is. And you can pick that up fairly quickly from, you know, just talking to multiple people. I mean, there is no substitute. You just have to talk to people at all kinds of different levels in the business and start to pick up on the character of the business. So is this a business that is led very strongly by a founder with a second-tier management that fundamentally is there to do what they are told, right? Yes, they can have some input, but fundamentally, it's a founder-led business and quite clearly run that way. And on the other hand, you've got on the other side a business where the leadership is very much around, well, you know, we're a family, we're a, you know, we want to develop people, we want to give people all kinds of opportunities. That's, yeah, that's an interesting one. And that's exactly what we found. And both of those are, you know, they're not, this isn't about wrong or right, but it's quite a trick to then say, okay, well, what do we want to be in terms of going forward? Now, where I then get a little firmer and start making decisions is, of course, if you want to scale, there's certain things you have to do. So, for example, when I talked about the complexity of the tech stack, that is going to, for a SaaS business, that will kill you. Right? For a SaaS business, you must have a single tech stack. And every time you diverge from that, or every time I've ever diverged from it or worked for businesses that have diverged from it, it has either hampered growth, which led to a sale, or it's actually sort of resulted in, you know, us pulling product lines because they just became unprofitable and you couldn't grow them. And I was obviously involved. I say obviously involved. I don't know if people probably wouldn't know my background, but back in the late 90s, I'm showing my age a bit here, there was a big battle for the ad serving market. And that was one of the very first big SaaS markets. And DoubleClick was up against Engage Exhibitor. DoubleClick is sold to Google for $3.1 billion. So it was quite successful, and it definitely won that race. But it won that race because it was a single tech stack and didn't have to spin up different instances. Essentially, it was single tech stack, single instance with multi-tenancy. And that's not the only way to scale. I would say, you know, as long as it's a single tech stack, if you have to spin up separate instances for security reasons, that's okay, as long as it's still consistent at core. But if what you do is spin up multiple versions with different tech stacks on them, you know, that just doesn't scale. So you then have to say, okay, well, if that's our business, then we're not going to rely on scaling up based on getting lots of customers. We have to rely on scaling up by building much deeper relations with the existing customer base. So you start, you know, the tech starts feeding into your commercial strategy, right? And a lot of people don't think about that. They kind of go, oh, the two are separate. Here, you guys build the tech and we'll figure out how to sell it and market it, right? Well, actually, no, because your goals are going to have to change if your tech absolutely does require that you build a separate instance for every customer, which some things do, let's be honest. And I started my career in, you know, very large scale systems integration with EDS, and pretty much everything was separate. But those were tens of millions contracts per annum for multi-years because they were doing very large things for governments and huge corporates. But, you know, speaking as a SaaS scale-up, that doesn't work at all. So bottom line is, I think that's where you get into strategy fitting with tech, fitting with people. How we made the decision was we said, look, well, there are certain things that we have to do. Okay, we have no choice. That's the law. We're certainly not going to step over the line there. However, we did say, right, we're looking for entrepreneurial thinking. We want people to take charge. At the same time, we said, and this was, I think, for some people, quite a hard message. No, we're not a family. We're a team. And some people were like, oh, what do you mean? And I said, well, look, I don't wish to appear harsh, but the reality is my son is never getting fired as my son, right? Doesn't matter what he does, he's not getting fired. But, you know, I play a team sport, volleyball. If one of our team is injured or not up to the standard required and is pulling the team down, then they're not playing. So we're a team. We're not a family. Everybody's got to contribute. Everybody's got to feel that they want to be part of the team. And that's also one of the big things that I find. I think a lot of CEOs maybe sort of end up in a position like mine, go, oh, I've got to sell to everyone. I've got to get everybody to feel positive and engaged. And there is a tendency sometimes to go overboard on that. And I do that. You do have to do it to some degree. But at the same time, I do sometimes say to people, make your own choice, right? I can tell you why I choose to be here, why I think this business is a great business, this is where I want to take it. But ultimately, you have to make a decision. Do you want to be on the train? I'm not going to oversell it to you. I'm going to say to you, do you believe in this? Does this work for you? And if yes, then great, and then commit fully. And if no, then let's just have an honest conversation about that. You know, if you're tired, if you've just acquired a business, somebody's worked their socks off for the last 5 years and they're just exhausted, and you come along and try and sell them on, it'll be great, stay, and they've got nothing left to give. In the short term, you go, great, I've kept that individual. In the long term, you regret it because people are going, what's up with so-and-so? Don't they believe in it anymore? And the answer is they probably do, but they've just run out of energy and they've got to a decent outcome. So I think there is a certain element where you have to sit down and be honest with people and say, do you want to do this? Are you up for going again? And if not, tell me. I'm not going to go, you've got to stay. I'll say, okay, how do we do this in a, you know, good way for both the business and you? But don't oversell it, because you need people that really want to do it. And there is a significant benefit, let's be candid, in bringing on board some new people that are completely fresh, because they don't have any of the baggage. So for example, for a little while here, we had one company that's based in Munich, another company that's based in Berlin. We had more of the C-level executives sitting in Berlin than we did in Munich, which created the impression amongst some of our team that, it's not a merger of two roughly equally sized companies and roughly equal top lines. It's a takeover of one by the other. And the fact that we chose the name for one because it was better known also kind of impacted that perception. Now, I think we've got past that now. You'd have to ask every single member of the team if they feel that that's been resolved. I think it has. Certainly, it seems all the way down to team lead level. People don't talk about any longer two separate businesses. But one of the ways that we sped that up was by bringing in new people who had none of the history. Right? They're not tainted by anything that's gone before. They just go, hey, this is what we have. This is exciting. Where do we go with it? So for me, that's always a good thing to do. If you've got people who are tired, people who are not fully on board, don't try and keep them. Don't try and oversell them. Ask them the question, do you buy this? And I won't tell you any names, obviously, because it would be unfair and unprofessional, but I did have a conversation with somebody where I said, look, I don't think your heart's in this. We were having the conversation, we should do this and we should do that. But the body language and the tone of voice was telling me, I was hearing these answers because that's what this individual thought they should say. And they were slightly scared of the consequences if they didn't. And in the end, I said, stop. I said, hold on a second. I don't think you really buy this, do you? This isn't really where you want to go. And eventually I got the answer. It's not where I envisaged going. And I went, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Let's find a place either within the business, which does fit where you want to go, or let's agree, a structured exit plan so you feel positive. You help us get the people that we need to take us to the next level. And we, throw a big party to thank you for everything you've done for the business and celebrate what you have done and what you've achieved. And so we did a fair bit of that. We said goodbye to people in a very positive way because we didn't have a role for them in the new business. I mean, one individual, people who know can guess who I'm talking about. We had an individual who was very much focused on doing mergers and acquisitions. After we'd got the two businesses, there was no need for that. And so rather than find a role for this individual that initially we'd been sort of going, okay, well, where do we put this individual? In the end, we just had a much more honest conversation and said, there isn't really a role here that you want to do, is there? And they said no. And I went, Great. Let's be honest about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was another revelation for me at some point at the very beginning, because I thought, okay, well, you're being bought. It's, you know, it's a new exciting journey. And then I realized, well, no, not really. It's kind of the same, but under, you know, under a bigger group with more, you know, stuff to it, a little bit more of a, you know, scale up situation, a bit more documentation, a bit more process. And not everybody, I mean, we buy companies, they're fairly small, and where people have enjoyed their freedom for quite a bit. So going into this scale up phase, they're like, yeah, maybe not, you know, and maybe, you know, not everyone realizes it at first. And yeah, then it's just a bit of an honest conversation later. But some people are like, yeah, we don't want to do that. Or they also sometimes just feel kind of uneasy and unsure what is going to happen. And it's like you said, it's your heart is no longer fully in it. And you don't want to work somewhere where you're uncertain what's going to happen to your role, or, you know, if an acquirer would, you know, want to keep you, but reposition you to another brand or some other role. So you don't want to be that kind of moving particle, and you just choose another way to go. But also, you know, and I'm really glad because we are discussing this so openly, because acquisitions, and we do that too. I mean, I create all that content where we say, okay, let's make an easy acquisition. Let's do a smooth and seamless transition integration period. But to be completely honest, there are bumps on the road, right? And one thing that a lot of founders don't estimate at first as well, and all the acquirers probably know, is that after an acquisition, there is this very fine balance that you have to find in order to not lose momentum, right? Because some founders, let's face it, they're so deep in this process, especially if the team is small, they just give it all. And for 3 months or however long the due diligence takes, they're just in due diligence. So the business is kind of in a wobbly state. So the acquirer gets it and they announce that the acquisition is done, and some customers get uneasy about this and they leave. So it's easy to kind of tip off there and lose your momentum. So what happened to you guys? How did you notify your customers? How did they react? You know, what was the period there?
So we were lucky in that most of the customers were pretty long term. We lost one major customer, but they had already before the merger and acquisition, they had already signaled that they were going to go. That was the, you know, so we had one major exit, but we had a sort of safe period, if you like, where people were kind of saying, okay, either the contract was long term so they couldn't cancel, or they were just saying, you know, giving us the benefit of the doubt. We had a little bit of a interesting situation in that the company had a lot of very stable customers. What it didn't have was much in the way of growth on either of the acquired businesses. You know, the new business sales was producing minimal uplift. Any uplift was just coming from existing customer base doing a little bit more. And that really, that created an opportunity for us, because, of course, the reason for that was both companies were massively technically focused. You know, we had an opportunity, and essentially the vision that we said to people was, look, you've created some great technology. You've got some fantastic blue chip customers. UBS and Deutsche and Commerzbank, N26, DKB, I could go on and on and on with some very, very large, big names that have been with us for a long time. But, you know, what we weren't doing was, because we didn't really have much in the way of a commercial setup on either side of the business. So that's when we had to say, okay, and back to that, where we kind of started, complexity. And how does that add value? But how do you turn it into simplicity in terms of how you're going to go out to the market? And so, you know, one of the first things I did was look at, wow, look at all the stuff that we sell. And if you're selling all of those different things, then all the different contracts, and remember, we're a regulated business, so we need all these, you know, separate statements on compliance, on GDPR, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think we had something like 27 annexes that you could potentially send out to a client. You know, you'd send them something out. If you ever printed it out, you know, you'd end up with a booklet that thick. And we said, hang on, this is not altogether surprising that we're not selling too much outside of to banks who need to do this. And even they are kind of a bit irritated because this is an awful lot of work on their side as well. Yes, they want to send us out compliance questionnaires, but really they'd like us to be able to send them back something that's fairly standard quickly that they can just go, okay, yep, you're good, rather than, you know, taking quite some while to come back and do everything individually. So, you know, there was a lot of opportunity to simplify, to basically say, okay, we are only selling really two core products, but there are certain sort of sub bits that you can buy, if you like, options within it. But it's kind of like, to use the car analogy, we're selling this model or this model. You can choose whether it's the color, you can choose whether you've got the aircon or not, and little things like that. But fundamentally, there's these two products, and they do this, and you can choose, you know, how sophisticated and how complex you want them to do those things. Whether, you know, I think I mentioned it earlier, whether you want us to actually take charge of interacting with third-party processors, pulling the data if you happen to be a bank, or whether you'd rather do that yourself. But the core technology stays the same. So there was an awful lot of work that we had to do really to turn it into a commercial operation to say, okay, you've got all these bits of tech. Let's simplify it down. Let's take all those components, package them up, and say, okay, what's the perfor what is the purpose? What do they do? Why would somebody buy it? Who's going to buy that? Whose problem does it solve? And I think, you know, sometimes people don't think about it in all the way through. So, for example, on the compliance side, so our Indigit product that we sell to the banks, people say, well, look, you know, we sell them everything they need. And I went, no, we don't. We sell them all the technology that they need to be compliant, but they're responsible for the compliance. Actually, what they would really like to buy is somebody else owning that problem. It's the difference between saying, I'll build you a bridge, and saying, I'll sell you 30, you know, 30-meter steel girders for you to build a bridge, right? That's the difference. And it's such a com and that's such a commercial. It's not a technical discussion, because the tech is fundamentally the same. You're just saying, hey, everybody gets everything, and it's standard, and we keep it up to date with all of the requirements so that we can sell a standard code base. And we can promise to people that we keep it updated at no further cost, because actually that's cheaper for us, because then we're still always maintaining one code base rather than having to maintain multiples.
So basically, what you're saying is after the merger, or probably before, you realized what is the core value that you could offer to the customer, focused on that, and just made sure that this is delivered.
I think, you know, in my case, as I said, I didn't get to do this in an ideal way, in that the merger happened in, I think, legally and officially in November 23, and I joined January 24. And to be candid, you know, I just completed an exit and sale, so I was actually getting a bit of a breather. So I came in fairly fresh in January, and with the merger already done, and did exactly what I just said you should try not to do, which is ideally you've done most of this before you've put everything together. You know how it all fits. So I didn't have that luxury. I had to basically figure this out. And this was it's actually a conversation with the CTO that triggered it, because I'm asking the question, well, you know, what have all of our customers actually got installed? And sat down, and I went, and then what happens when PSD3 comes along, which is the new PSD version, not not live yet, or what happens when, BaFin, sorry, not BaFin, it was BaFin, sorry. The regulator suddenly says you must do instant payments through your PSD API, right? And you've got to have it live by October. I said, well, how do we do that? Are we going to have to do that differently for each client? I said, that's a lot of work. Wouldn't it be easier if we just do it once centrally and then just do change the business model, change the commercial relationship that says, okay, we're not going to charge you to do that build for every customer. You're just going to pay a little bit more for it up front, and we're going to keep it up to date. So it was really it was sort of driven by practicalities as well as the realization that that was something that actually the customers would want as well.
Yeah,
It was like, hang on,
exactly.
now we're properly solving the problem and taking ownership of it where they want us to do that, rather than just giving them the tools to do the job, but leaving them with the responsibility of actually delivering compliance.
All right. Yeah, that's really, every time, it's so interesting. On the podcast, there are a lot of very kind of different problems that we're talking about, and every time we get to fairly the same solutions, right? Talk to your customers, make sure you know what the value is, make sure you know what you're building, who you're building for, but at the end of the day, we come to the same thing. But every time I speak to a new founder or a new CEO, everyone says we had this problem before we came to the realization. And I'm like, okay, well, 250 episodes we of this podcast. I mean, yeah.
But it's inevitable. Anna, I think it is inevitable because, and I'll tell you why. So I've only been a founder once. Okay. So I've had six exits, but I've only been a founder once. So I have huge respect for founders because you've got to go, I see a need for something that other people don't see. I'm prepared to take one of the riskiest business decisions you will ever take. I mean, we all know the stats are not good, right? For a startup business, the number that succeed is very low, right? So you're putting your passion, you're putting your energy, you're putting your cash, you're putting all of that on the line. So you've got to be a real believer, right? You've got to really believe in that. And have the smarts and the wherewithal to withstand people going, oh, that's not going to work. Yeah, can't see that going anywhere, which you will hear, right? So you've got somebody who's passionate about something, and they bring together people initially who are probably similarly passionate, and so they love the thing. Okay, there's a show I'm watching on the I think it's. Well, I won't name the service just in case we shouldn't do that. Of a guy who, is a famous TV personality, and he sets up a business restoring cars, right? But he doesn't know about business, but he's passionate about old cars. And most of the series is him failing to successfully turn that into a business that makes any money or grows or does anything, right? But he loves it, right? Unfortunately, he's got the resources that came from being a successful TV personality, probably to allow him to continue to do that. But that happens, I just see it again and again and again. And what that manifests in, and I think, with Quist, it was very much the case, I ran an incubator for a while and sat across from hundreds of small businesses that basically had built something fantastic because that's what they believed in. But they had completely neglected the sales and the marketing and the commercialization of it. They had operated on the, if we build it, they will come. If it's the best, then of course people will buy it. And I still remember a really, I've never forgotten this. This was quite a while ago. I had a conversation with this guy, and he was like, "Well, we can't go live with this because it's not as good as it could be." I said, "But it's brilliant. It's better than anything else." Yeah, but in years to come, when we're successful. This will come back and bite us in like 5, 6 years' time. And I went, but how does anybody know it's better? He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you walk into a private prospect and you tell them yours is the best. He went, yeah, because it is. I said, but your competitor walks into the same prospect and says they're the best. Yeah, but they're not. And I'm like, yes, but how does the prospect know that? And it was genuinely a failure to communicate, because he was just like, but we are the best, you know, it's obvious. And I went, no, it's not. It's not yeah. obvious, right? It's you've got to walk in there and you've got to tell people what the value is. You know, you go to somebody who wants to buy a people transporter and start getting all passionate about, you know, how fantastic ceramic composite brakes are. Watch the eyes glaze over extremely quickly. Are they the best? Yes. Does it matter in that circumstance? No. Right. And that's the thing, you know. So you get individuals who are of necessity passionate about their product, and they believe in their product, and a lot of them think that passion is going to work, and they don't understand that actually they're going to have to do the hard yards. They are going to have to market that product. They've got to explain to people why what they've done is better. And it's not just going to happen unless they get lucky. I mean, the other one I came across, which again always made me laugh, was people would say, yeah, you know, I'd say, what's your marketing strategy? How are you? You know, what's your go to market? And they go, well, we've got a viral plan. And my response to that was, a viral plan is not a plan. That's like writing your household budget, assuming you're going to win the lottery. That's a hope. You know, there's 5 to 7 million businesses start all across the world every year. Rough numbers. Who knows the exact number, but it's the one I read. How many have you heard of? How many of those 5 to 7 million businesses yeah. have you heard of? Right. The reality is, yes, somebody does win the lottery. Yes, some businesses do get found virally and suddenly explode. In fact, really? Usually suddenly explode really looks more like a, you know, asymptotic growth curve with very, very slow growth. And then suddenly they get, you know, there's an event happens that starts pushing them into a much more aggressive growth. But they've been around for a while. Yeah. You suddenly hear of them when they go through that phase. Yes.
This gets released. They're like, oh, they are an overnight success.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you look at MySpace, you look at Facebook, all of them. If you track it back to when they really started, it was absolutely that, right? So they didn't. They weren't overnight successes. Very few businesses are. But then most people don't get that. You know, get super lucky. Somebody very famous suddenly wears your clothes or your jewelry or something, and everybody wants to buy it. That's, you know, most businesses aren't going to get that. So I think, you know, this is why you get inevitably people who are super passionate about the product, and they do tend to assume that if it's the best, that people will just naturally buy it. And you have to disabuse them of the notion and say, and sometimes the best is very subtle. Okay. So it's, you know, I remember talking to somebody and they went, oh, you know, this is amazing. So we can do this. We can detect all of this information and we can send it to people. And I went, well, how do you send it to them? Oh, well, we go with an API first approach. Great. But what about other delivery mechanisms? Oh, no, API is first, because then they can have it exactly like they want it. I went, yes, but they also then need their tech team spend time to integrate your product. And yes, you can do all kinds of stuff, but wouldn't it be nice if you could just deliver this information as an email or a PDF? So, oh, well, that's pretty old tech. I went, yeah, but it works fast and they can have it now. And, oh, well, yeah, okay, I guess so. It's, you know, it's frequently people think about, you know, how great the product is. They don't think about how easy it is to sell. They don't understand, for example, that if you can create something that is clear commercially and demonstrate that's going to be much easier to grow and to convince people to take the step with you than if you're saying, hey, we can do anything. You know, this is brilliant all around general technology. It does this and this and this and this and this. But then the question becomes, well, who are you talking to? And possibly you're going into somebody and saying, yes, my product can do this, 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 and this. What's the other person hearing, right? They're hearing one bit that they're interested in, and then they've got somebody telling them how great it is at doing something that in which you have no interest. So I think, you know, I shy away in general from saying there is an exact mix of, you know, product and engineering to marketing and sales within an organization. But if you look at an organization and discover that 80% of the team is product and engineering, 12% is, you know, general and admin, and only 5 to 8% is commercial marketing and sales, you go, well, this is not a business that's going to scale in general. There's not, as I said, you if you've got a handful of very, very large customers, possibly. So there are always exceptions. But in general,
yeah,
if your average deal size is within a sort of, you know, 4 to 5 figure range, in fact, probably even 6 these days, you know, you need a sensible sized commercial team, however good your technology is.
Very interesting. I mean, we've had all kinds of stories here on the podcast, and I could probably remember a few companies that only have tech teams, tech product design, all in one without any marketing and sales, that are very successful bootstrapped companies. But in terms of scaling, I think you're still absolutely right, because at the end of the day, they do start hiring marketing and sales when they get to, say, 7-8 million. And there, you know, to jump to 10 and higher, they probably need somebody else who can bring those bigger checks. But, you know, it's great to hear that. You know, it's a bit of a, you know, kind of a bit more down to earth perspective on both, you know, scaling and acquisitions than I usually hear here on the podcast. So that's, to be honest, that's refreshing, not trying to sell all the rainbows and butterflies to the founders. So I think, yeah, I would love to do it again sometime, because, you know, you joined a year ago, almost a year ago. No.
Year and a half now.
Year and a half now. Oh my God.
Yeah, it goes by quickly.
True. So yeah, I wonder how you guys are going to look like maybe another year, because first year is usually this honeymoon, even for acquisitions. And then to see how everything you just said came into perspective as you actually scale together would be really great.
Yeah, no, love to have further conversations. I think, yeah, I guess it's just you know, bitter experience where you start going, you do inevitably end up in the weeds. You have to keep, you know, I always say, when you're planning in these kind of environments, midterm plans are useless, right? What you need is a 2 to 3 year goal. Where do you want to be in 2 to 3 years time? And what are you going to do tomorrow to get there? And that's really the thing. So you've got to be super pragmatic, because you're in such a dynamic environment that trying to go, okay, we'll be here in 6 months and we'll be here in 12 months. Typically you've got to build those plans, but you've also got to be realistic and say, what really matters is, what do people do differently tomorrow? Yeah, and it's a message that I preach a lot. The team's probably fed up of it. I'm saying, look, yeah, here's our big goal. That's where we want to be. But the only way we get there is you do something slightly better tomorrow. And if everybody does something a little bit better tomorrow, in 6 months, things look a lot better. And in 12 months, they look much better still. But it's what you do different tomorrow that matters, not what you're going to do in 6 months' time. So I do tend to be a little bit pragmatic and say, right, okay, this is where we want to be. Right, what are we going to do? What are we going to do now? And how are we going to get there? You know, I usually find that if you oversell, you lose people. They might, if you give them a slightly tough message, they might not like it initially, but they probably respect you more for it in the end. Because it also gets people where they really need to be. And I think, and that's what I fundamentally believe is if you have people in the wrong place in an organization and they're not motivated and they're not happy, then ultimately they're not, you know, it's not going to work. It's not good for them and it's not good for the business.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time. Like I said, it was a real pleasure talking to you, and I hope we get to do this again sometime.
Thank you very much indeed. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I'm glad you did. And take care.
Thanks so much.